Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Hey, clones. Welcome back to the Daily Jungle. Monday now in the books. Floyd Mayweather may have won that fight, but Conor McGregor did not lose a thing. Get my take on the fight as we break down the entire thing. And maybe just as good, the undercard, Dana White v. Oscar De La Hoya. Three nice guests today. We had Kevin Ioli, UAB football coach Bill Clark with the Blazers back from the dead, and Yahoo baseball writer and Smackoff medalist Jeff freaking Passan. A ton of show, so Alvy, let's get it right now. Let's get right at it. Mayweather-McGregor, the most hype fight ever. I mean, there was a world tour involved. Verbal sparring, Instagram jabs, and the truth is, nothing ever lives up to the hype. Never. But this did. Hell, I might even go as far as to say it exceeded the hype. Now, was it the greatest fight ever? No. Was it the complete joke and farce and debacle that most people thought it would be? No. In fact, not even close. Conor showed up well as a boxer, especially in the first few rounds, and he was a warrior throughout. This guy's got nothing to be embarrassed about, and he proved yet again he's tough as hell. Mayweather-McGregor was better than Mayweather-Pacquiao. Fact. Not only that, but McGregor landed more punches than Pacquiao did. There could be any number of reasons for that, but the truth is, this fight was more entertaining than the fight of the century that took nearly a century to get made. In other words, if you dropped $100 on that fight, you were buying it for the event, and it more than delivered. Totally worth it. You should have gone in expecting an event, and if you did, you got one. Like many of you, I dropped $100 of my own money on that fight. I know I got my money's worth. And even if you've been living under a rock, you still know that Floyd Mayweather stopped Conor McGregor in the 10th round.
Talking about a guy in his first pro boxing fight, here in round 10 against Floyd Mayweather. And Floyd Mayweather landing the right hands now at will and tags McGregor again. Floyd Mayweather has McGregor on the ropes, literally and figuratively. How is the notorious one still standing?
That's it.
Robert Byrne has stopped the fight. But what a night it has been here in Las Vegas.
Credit to Showtime. And if you want to see that replay, it will be on September 2nd on Showtime. Hey, listen, don't think for a second that Conor lost that fight. He won. Even when he lost, he won. And not just because he's walking off with something in the neighborhood of 100 mil. Coming out of that fight, it was all about Conor, not Floyd. Sure, money's going to walk away with a boatload of jack, but the story is Conor and the fact that he showed up so much better than anybody could have ever expected. And it sure looked like he was better than Floyd expected, especially in the first three or four rounds. He looked very confident and comfortable for somebody who had never been in a professional boxing match before and was in against a Hall of Famer. I mean, sure, there was the weirdness with the hammer fists, but there were no elbows, no kicks, and plenty of solid punches. Trust me, Conor may have lost that fight, but he won the night. And he came out of this looking way better than he did going into it. Now, once Floyd got out of the first three rounds, the result was never in doubt. I mean, Conor put everything he had into the first few rounds, knowing that that was his chance to get Floyd out. Hit him with the good bleep early when he's not used to your style or your angles, and maybe you catch him off guard. Maybe you can end it quickly. But when that didn't happen, it was only a matter of time before the unbeaten boxer beat the inexperienced boxer. Yes, Floyd started slowly, but he always does. Yes, it took him longer to figure out Conor than most of the guys he's been in with, but it was only a matter of time before he did, especially when Conor started to gas. And then the only question was how long he'd last. The fact that he lasted into the 10th round against the best fighter of this generation says something. It says a lot. And in the process, he got Floyd to open up and throw punches. We haven't seen that Floyd in years. Almost never, in fact. So yeah, it was worth it. It was totally worth it for the fighters and for the fans. And when was the last time you could say that about a Mayweather fight? When was the last time you came out of a Mayweather fight saying that was worth it? What a great fight. What a great show. And as good as the fight was, Conor was even better after when he was asked about the stoppage. And you saw him there. Quote, "I've been strangled on live TV and came back. So I don't know. I would have liked him to just let it go. Bleep it. I got in here in the squared circle. Everything was different. It was a lot more fun. End quote. I've been strangled on live TV and came back. It's one of the most badass things you'll ever hear in a post-fight interview. And if that wasn't, what came later was, quote, that's exactly what it is, fatigue. That's why I thought the ref could have just let it keep going. Let me go down. Let the man put me down, end quote. As in, let me have the chance to get knocked the bleep out. Give me the Warriors finish to the fight. And he said it more than once, quote, I get a little wobbly and flowy, but bleep, get me into the corner and I'll recover and I'll come back. And I'd like it to hit the floor, end quote. Again, when was the last time you heard a fighter say, I'd like to hit the floor? I'll tell you, never. That never happens. When a fighter's complain that a stoppage was too early, they're usually already out on their feet and trying to argue that they could have won. But in this case, he was saying, give me a chance to win it or to get the knock the hell out. Don't end it like this. You know, that's some old school gladiator, warrior code type bleep. And it was awesome. Like most of the fight. And if you've got a problem with that, you probably got a problem with yourself. I thought it was great. I thought it was worth it. I thought it lived up to it. I thought it was a great show. And even when he loses, he wins. Conor comes out of that looking better than he did going in. And Floyd did what he had to do. He did what you knew he'd do. Look, Floyd's not what he was. He definitely is not what he was. But still, he's going to outclass a guy like that. And he did. All right, so where did he come out? You've seen the fight. I've got a lot more angles and thoughts on that fight, but I want to give you my basic thought that it was worth it. It was a great night. Great show. Kevin Ioli is my guest. Now, back, Kevin, when the fight was announced, you and I talked about how the buildup would be great, but the fight would not be good at all. As we got closer and closer, had your thought process changed, and what kind of expectations did you have for the fight and for Conor McGregor in particular?
Well, you know, I went into the fight, and I think my preview, the fight played out exactly what I said in my prediction preview column. You know, I said, hey, the first two or three rounds, Mayweather's going to just start slow and figure him out. The footwork was going to be an issue. Once he figured him out, he would start landing. I said the lead right hand was going to be a big punch for him. And all that played out. You know, I think the thing that was surprising was McGregor, two things. He did not try any of the different stances and the different kind of footwork. He moved traditionally like a boxer. You know, a lot of people thought he might try some karate stances, some capoeira stances, and different martial arts that he might use. You know, not that he was going to try a move, but, you know, footwork type things. He didn't do that, so, you know, he just fought as a traditional boxing stance. But I thought he acquitted himself very well. I mean, he lost the fight, clearly. After Mayweather kind of figured him out, it was a one-sided affair. But, you know, hey, McGregor fought one of the greatest boxers of all time, and you know, in his pro debut, I thought he did at least as well as, if not better than Manny Pacquiao.
Oh, I think so for sure, Kevin. I think he acquitted himself very well. I enjoyed that fight way better than Mayweather-Pacquiao. Kevin, I only my guest. Now, Conor seemed pretty irritated by the fact that Robert Byrd jumped in to stop that fight in the 10th, but was there any doubt in your mind that the stoppage was correct?
No, I thought it was correct. You know, he was being batted around the ring. You know, a couple times I think he bumped into the ropes. I think the ropes held him up, Jim. And, you know, you just can't take those unanswered punches like that. And he said, hey, give me till the end of the round. But there was still a lot of time left in the round. I mean, you know, there was a lot of right hands for him to eat. You know, if you're going to say, well, let him get to the stool and get his rest. I mean, I think they absolutely made the right call on that. And, you know, it saved him to fight for another day. No question about it.
Kevin, I only my guest. One more thing about Byrd. What was your reaction to how he handled Conor's hammer fists and Floyd's apparent willingness to duck his head and turn his back to Conor?
Yeah, I did not think Robert had that good of a night. I mean, and certainly I think the hammer fist should have been called. You can't be hitting on top of the head like that. And, you know, he was warned a number of times, but I didn't think – I just thought, you know, he had a bad night overall. At one point he shoved Mayweather back into the corner, and I don't think you ever put your hands on the fighter like that in a situation like that. And I thought he had a poor night. You know, he's a better referee than I think he showed that night. And, you know, frankly, hey, the two judges that had it 8-1, I think they've had better nights. I mean, McGregor clearly won the first three rounds. I don't know where those two judges were coming up with giving Mayweather 8 out of 9 rounds. No chance.
Kevin Ioli joining us. I had it scored the same way, Kevin, like you did. I had him winning the first three rounds before Mayweather got the fourth. Now, Mayweather, Kevin, had been off for nearly 2 years, and when you have a layoff like that, especially at his age, there's always that possibility that it's going to catch up to you. How did he look to you over the course of the fight?
I thought he looked like a guy whose fastball was gone a little bit. I mean, I did not think he was the same guy. I looked at his record over the day because I wanted to see how many of his fights I had covered, and it was 43 out of 50 out of his pro fights. So I missed seven of his fights. And, you know, he was a different guy Saturday night than he was previously. You know, he said that a lot in the build-up to the fight, and I took it mostly as him trying to promote the event and, you know, making people think McGregor had a chance. But, you know, as I looked at him, I didn't think he was the same super speedy guy, and I thought there were some openings that he could have taken advantage of that he did not. You know, I don't say that to denigrate McGregor, because, again, I'll go on and say that McGregor did a spectacular job. But I just thought Mayweather, you know, fought. He was still very good, and he was still beating a lot of very good boxers on that night. But he wasn't the super boxer that he has been most of his career.
And then in terms of McGregor, we've got a pretty good idea of what Saturday did for his bank account. But what did Saturday do for his reputation?
I think it did nothing but burnish it. I mean, I think when you look at this guy, you know, now there's other boxers that want to fight him. I think if he fights Paulie, he goes in there and he's got $1 million, $1.5 million by fight right there. You know, I don't know that that's the wisest fight to make, given that Paulie had already retired and certainly was on the downslide. But, you know, that's a fight that people will buy and people will talk about. I think he acquitted himself extraordinarily well in the fight. And I think it was obvious, Jim, hey, if this guy had trained in boxing for a long time, he would be a factor in his weight class. You know, he hasn't done that, and at this age, I don't know if, given his skill in martial arts, mixed martial arts, that he's ever going to be able to get there. But certainly, I think he has a ton of options, and if he has a guy that he wants to fight again, I'm sure that person will want to fight him because they know it's going to be a big money fight.
To your point, I think that given his age and given how accomplished he is in mixed martial arts, you're right, for him to start a boxing career right now might be a little bit too late, but even he himself said he likes the checks in boxing. So if you had to guess, Kevin, do you feel like that was a one-off and he'll go back to MMA, or could you see him boxing again?
I do think it's a one-off, and I don't, you know, I think if he boxes again, the Paulie fight is really the only one that he takes, because it's a fight that, you know, Paulie's not a big puncher, you know, it's probably not dangerous. It's the only fight that I can think of that you know right now that he could take that will be a fair match that also would sell. You know, if you look at him against a Keith Thurman, I mean, Keith Thurman, I think 28 years old in the prime of his career, a knockout artist. I don't think that's a fight you make for Conor right now, because he doesn't have the experience as a boxer to match up to somebody like Thurman. So, you know, and he has fights in the UFC that are going to make him a ton of money. If he fights Nate Diaz in that trilogy fight, that's a huge fight. That's going to make a ton of money. If he fights the winner of Kevin Lee and Tony Ferguson, if he fights Khabib, you know, so he has fights in the UFC. Nothing that's going to make him what he made against Mayweather, but there's no boxing match other than a rematch with Mayweather that would make him that much either. So I think, you know, as I look at it, I think he's going to focus on MMA because that's what he's good at. That's where he's trained all his life or most of his adult life. And I think he's going to, you know, be in line for some massive paydays with those fights I mentioned.
Kevin Ioli joining us. All right, so boxing has Triple G and Canelo Alvarez coming up in 3 weeks. How do you see that fight, the fight of the year, going?
I really love that fight. I think that's going to be a spectacular fight, to be honest with you. I hope it turns out in the ring the way I think it will. But, you know, I think that's going to be a very high-level chess match because, you know, Canelo has to be concerned about the punching power of Gennady. I think Canelo is the better pure boxer, but I think it's like, you know, both guys have power, both guys can box, and I think it's going to be the one who establishes himself and establishes what he wants to do. I think Gennady's really has a statement he wants to make in this fight, Jim. You know, I look at him and say, you know, he did not perform as well against Danny Jacobs as a lot of people thought he would. And some people are saying that Canelo took the fight because he looked bad, so this is the right time to get him. And I think Gennady is going to look at this and say, hey, I want to make a statement in this fight, and so I'm going to come forward. So I think you're going to see the best Gennady Golovkin in this fight. And the punching power is going to be the determining factor, I believe, and I don't think Canelo hits as hard as Triple G does, and Triple G has a heck of a chin, too. So I think I will pick Gennady Golovkin to win the fight.
Okay, can't wait to see that one. All right, Kevin, before you go, one more topic. In the middle of the buildup to Saturday's fight, we had the news that Jon Jones failed that drug test before UFC 214. If it truly is a failed test for an anabolic steroid, why do you think Jones would take something like that when he's already coming back from a drug suspension? In other words, do you think that he thought that he wouldn't get caught, or does he just not have the confidence to fight without it?
You know, I think a lot of us, you know, we look at these guys as, you know, just supermen, you know, what they can do. But, you know, they're human beings just like us, and they have the same insecurities that you and I have. You know, they're just a lot better athletes than we are. Jones, you know, we don't know that he took this, but if in fact he did it knowingly, then I think the only answer is the fact that, you know, hey, look what it benefits. The two things it benefits, recovery from hard training, and it gives you greater endurance. And those are two things that certainly would benefit an MMA fighter. You know, hey, those guys have to train like maniacs. There's few athletes on earth that have to do the training that MMA fighters do. So I think between that and so the recovery benefits and then the endurance that you get from that, you know, you're going against a guy like DC. Jon Jones knows as well as anybody how good DC is. I think that's the answer. You know, if in fact he took it knowingly, I think that's the answer that, you know, hey, he's human. He has some insecurities. He knows what he's facing on the other side of the ring, and he wanted to be at the top of his game.
So going back to last week also, just as we went off the air on Friday, the undercard for Mayweather-McGregor started, and that was Friday, and it did not disappoint. Oscar De La Hoya versus Dana White, a heavyweight fight if there ever was one. And if you don't know why these two would be getting after it, you know, here's the obvious background. Right after the Canelo Alvarez, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. dog of a fight went down in May, De La Hoya wasted no time jumping into the ring to announce the much-anticipated super fight between Canelo and Triple G. Then he set the date for September 16th. And make no mistake, on paper, it is a massive fight. The fight of the year, years in the making. A fight that everybody in boxing wants to see badly. But for as big in the boxing world as Canelo and Triple G are, they're still not household names for casual fans. So when Dana White and Mayweather Promotions announced their fight a few weeks later and booked a date 3 weeks ahead of De La Hoya lost his mind. And if I'm being honest, it's hard to blame him. Because if you're De La Hoya and you've got what looks to be the biggest promotion of the year, and then shortly thereafter it gets undercut by the century's biggest promotion, you're going to be bent. So since then, Oscar has grabbed whatever mic he could find to shout down McGregor Mayweather. Some kind of farce that was going to ruin the sport of boxing forever. He even took to Facebook to ask fans to boycott. But then on Friday, some 30 hours before the fight, he came completely unhinged and went with a four-letter nuke on Twitter. Quote, F you, Mayweather McGregor. Both of you are disrespecting the sport of boxing. Well, it didn't take long for that to work its way back to Dana, of course. And he didn't take it lying down. And he countered by screenshotting the tweet, putting it on his gram, and captioning it, quote, WTF, is this guy snorting coke and drinking booze again? Hashtag Oscar De La Arum. Damn, Dana. 10-8 round for Dana. Here's Dana then explaining the social media interaction to Yahoo Sports.
Just finished the weigh-ins. I'm back here in my room. I'm going through my tweets, and there's a tweet from Oscar De La Hoya that says, F*** Mayweather McGregor, you guys are disrespecting the sport, and just this guy has lost his mind. It's just crazy. I can't believe a guy coming out and just being so negative about a fight. Hey, Oscar, focus on your fight. Focus on your fight. Are you nuts? Have you seriously lost your mind? Are you snorting cocaine again and drinking booze? Seriously, what's wrong with you, man? You're Oscar De La Hoya, for Christ's sakes. You were a world champion. You're a promoter. You're promoting a fight that's going to be a great fight between two great fighters. Here, let me help promote his fight for him. It's going to happen a couple weeks after this fight, and it's a very good fight. You don't have to act like a because this fight is happening. And Oscar, if you don't like the fight, then don't watch the fight. A lot of people want to watch the fight. The fans wanted this fight. The media wanted this fight. That's it.
Pretty much. That was it. And Dan is right. Oscar does have an amazing fight. And he should be promoting that great fight. Because people don't know Canelo and Triple G. I mean, that's the fight now. That's the fight, obviously, more than this previous fight. But people don't know those two the way they know Mayweather and McGregor. And there's no doubt that Canelo Triple G is the superior fight. And it should sell well, despite Mayweather and McGregor getting everybody, dinging everybody for $100. And to Dana's point, whether he likes to admit it or not, and maybe Oscar does really know this, right? Maybe killing Saturday's fight is a tactical play by De La Hoya, a great way to get those crossover and non-boxing purists to check out his fight. Because Saturday's fight did a hell of a lot more to help than it did to hurt Oscar. It got the entire world to stop what it was doing Saturday night and watch boxing. Talk boxing. When was the last time that happened? And here we are a couple of days later, and they're still doing it. That did not ruin the sport of boxing. It propped it up. That wasn't the worst thing for boxing. It was the best. And with the fight of the year coming up now, that can't be anything good but for Oscar. And he couldn't have asked for a better lead-in to his fight than that fight, because his fight should be better. So instead of killing Dana and Mayweather and McGregor, Oscar probably should be thanking them. Just know this, even an apology, if it were to come for Oscar, was not going to be accepted by Conor.
Conor, anything to say to Oscar De La Hoya?
Him. Guess not. So that was something. You want to talk about whether or not the undercards had any fireworks. That did. Dana White v. Oscar. Those guys got after it. And that was Friday, right before we went off the air and prior to that fight. Let's go to Syracuse. First stop today, Josh in Syracuse. It's good to have you, Josh. How are you?
Hey, Zim, great to be on the show, and I think you got it exactly right. You know, good fight. Everybody got their money's worth. And people that are complaining about the stoppage, you know, those are the casual fans that just went to a big viewing party, and they don't really understand that that was the right stoppage to make in boxing. When somebody's just getting pounded squarely in the face over and over again, it takes a toll on your brain. It's just like in the NFL, if somebody goes helmet to helmet, you don't leave them in to get another concussion. You take them out. You have them go through the protocol that's right. And this was the best thing for the rest of Conor's career, because clearly he's got some talent, but if he had kept going with Mayweather like he said he could after the fight, something might have gone really wrong for him afterwards. And you want to do what's best for the guy's health. The wallet comes afterwards, $100 million payday at least for both of them. And who needs to take all the brain damage with that?
You're exactly right, Josh. Thanks so much. No, you're right. Let's give it a shot. We go to Maine. Brian in Maine. Brian, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Jim, how are you doing, bud?
I'm great. How about you?
All right. I called last week, and I'm calling to eat a little crow butt with you because you were right on the mark with what you had to say. I'm a 37-year martial artist, and I can tell you that MMA training is there on the clock and 25 minutes normally. And I called you last week and said, you know, this is going to be a knockout, first, second, third round most. I never thought Conor would go 10. So kudos to Conor, and what an awesome fight. And, I mean, I paid for it. I listened to you, and you were right, because Mayweather had the expertise. But if Conor would have just nailed it in that first three or four rounds and been able to do it, would have been done. Now, on the other side, we're wrong. He's not a gladiator for wanting to continue. He is a Japanese martial artist, so he is a samurai. He's the type of guy that would rather die than to just fold his cards and fold up his tent. So I kind of do appreciate, because I'm a Shotokan martial artist, I do appreciate that Japanese tenure and cultural acceptance with what he's saying.
Now I hear you, Brian. I'm glad you called back, Brian. Respect to you, and I appreciate you, and I'll tell you why. More guys should be like that. More guys should listen to this show and then call me and tell me that I'm wrong and why they disagree, and then call after the fact and say, you were right, Rome. I'm here to slam a crow sando. We're taking telephone calls. Let's go to Santa Fe this time. Robert in Santa Fe. It's good to have you, Robert.
Hold on, Rome. Transplant from Hermosa Beach to Santa Fe, working the Zozobra. Look it up. Anyway, man, I don't know what these cookie cutter people are talking about. That fight was junk, man. It looked like Conor McGregor's hands had 5 pounds weight. And I had to watch the replay like 5 times to watch the fight again. And I couldn't believe they were talking about McGregor just like throwing down on him and things of that. Mayweather wasn't throwing punches. He had 12 punches in the first three rounds. He just went Apollo Creed on him. I couldn't believe the fight. It was a joke. If Mayweather would have been in his prime, he would have got his butt whooped even more. And I wanted to see McGregor go down. I wanted to hit him so hard so that he wouldn't have a chance to talk after the fight. And that referee, that old man that was refereeing that fight, if you can't break up 252-pound guys, then you shouldn't be in the ring. And you're a Hall of Fame referee of some sort, you can't even break them? That was a joke, and he should have never stopped that. He should have looked at McGregor's fights, and that's what's wrong with boxing nowadays. McGregor, I just can't believe McGregor couldn't even get through the first 10 guys in the 152-pound boxing ring. If you can name 10 guys in that group, he couldn't get.
Bro, you're all over the map now. You're all over the map with this. Let me respond to some of that, Robert. Thanks. All right, so there's our first call through saying, I don't know what these cookie cutters are talking about. That was junk. That was junk. He goes, I wanted to see McGregor get knocked out so badly that he couldn't talk. First of all, that would never happen. Well, he might get knocked out. But this thing about him not being able to talk, the only way this guy's not able to talk is if he's not able to breathe. We are joined by the head coach at UAB, Bill Clark. Countdown to kickoff clock that you have outside your office. It counts the number of days until kickoff. What was the number of days to kickoff when the clock went up, Bill, and what's it like to see where it is right now?
I just remember 500 and something. I don't remember much other than that, but it was, you know, it was one of the things where when I put it up, I thought, okay, this is really going to serve this great purpose and remind us. And then I looked up and it was over 500 days. And I said, what am I doing? I think I've messed up here, you know, cause I'm reminding these guys how long we got to go. But I think it's all remind us, you know, that we were working for a purpose and there was a day when we were going to actually play again. And, you know, it turned out okay, but it was a little daunting at the start.
All right, so here you are right now, and fall camp isn't nearly a lot of fun or isn't necessarily a lot of fun for the players or even the coaches, but when you're in position or in the position you're in right now and you're getting ready to play an opponent on Saturday for the first time in years, how exciting then has the whole process been?
I tell you what, it's really been special. I think for us, too, to see marked improvement, obviously, if you've seen the things that have happened here, you know, we've raised $44 million from you know, alumni and our community, and to bring the program back and then to build this facility, which is, you know, state of the art. And, you know, all the great things that are going on at UAB and in our community, you know, we've got a lot of great talks about this new stadium we're going to build soon. And, you know, I think to see all this happening and as we bring recruits in and we tell them we're going from a bad facility to a good one, they see it getting built. And, you know, now to be here, you know, less than a week away from playing, it's pretty great.
Bill Clark joining us. I'm going to circle back to that facility in a minute because it's amazing what you've gotten done there and the amount of money that's been raised for it. But for those who don't recall, we should go back to December of 2014. You were coming off your first season at UAB. You led the team to bowl eligibility for the first time in a decade. You were named the Conference Coach of the Year. And then the school just up and announces that the program is being disbanded. What was the entire experience like for you?
Yeah, you know, we don't talk about it a lot anymore. I think me and you talked not long thereafter. But, I think to live through that moment was, you know, probably in a lot of ways was as bad as it gets. And then to be on the other side of it is, and to be where we are now is as good as it gets, I think. So from something really bad and terrible to something really great, you know, it's been a long journey.
You know, Bill, I can respect that. You don't talk about it very much. And you and I did speak actually in July of 2015 after it was announced. You know, fact is, you could have left after the program was disbanded. Why didn't you?
Gosh, there was a bunch of reasons. You know, I think when it first happened, I was so much into getting coaches' jobs and players. Really, first was players getting them placed. I mean, I turned into a high school coach again and having to sell my own players to go get them scholarships, and which that took a while. And I think while that was going on, it was an unbelievable fight going on from this community and this city and the students, and it was a roller coaster. I would say that, but I think there was enough hope there and enough things going on that I wanted to give it every opportunity to come back. I mean, I'm from this state, and I always thought that Birmingham and UAB could be something special if we just, you know, if we put the resources and the commitment came, and, you know, I think now that's kind of where we're headed. But I think all those things kind of went into the factor of me sticking around to give it a chance.
Bill Clark joining us. Huge weekend coming up. But you did go to work. You went to work. You went to work recruiting and selling a program that was not going to play a game until 2017. That's a very different challenge. How did you go about doing that, and what was your message to prospects?
I think I had, you know, one of the things I had was some time on my hands. And, okay, how do we even have a chance at this if we come back? And at the time, Brent Manowski, who was our conference commissioner, Conference USA was really good to us. They wanted us back. They knew, you know, how important UAB and Birmingham was to this conference and really just college football in general. And I think they wanted to give us every chance. You know, we worked with the NCAA, and they didn't give us a lot of things because they didn't want to be unfair to anybody else. But I think one of the things they did was we were allowed to guys that came in that first year, you know, they didn't lose any eligibility. So that allowed us to really go out across the country and sell the fact specifically to guys that were maybe were coming off injury or maybe wanted to work academically or really just come in here and train that, hey, come in here, do this for a year, grow with us, help build this, you know. You know, as our my standing line was, you know, who's going to play your part in the movie? You know, because this is going to be a movie. You know, and the NCAA told us they'd never seen anything like it. So I think that's what we've been selling. That's what they bought into. The former players that stayed around helped to sell. And, gosh, they recruited as hard as coaches did for us. And I think they were selling what kind of family atmosphere we had going in 14. And, you know, I think for those guys and for all of them to see this thing come to fruition is very special.
UAB head football coach Bill Clark joining us. You know, Bill, one more thought about that turnaround, too. In your first season as head coach back in 2014, you took over a team that had gone 2-10 the year before. You turn it around. You become bowl eligible in just one season. How does the challenge of turning around a program compare with completely rebuilding the program?
I think there's some similarities, and I think there's some other things that are, you know, that are obviously totally different. I think that having done that a bunch of times, and probably, you know, that was one of those things where it's almost like the experience of being a high school coach all those years, me going to South Alabama and helping start that program, being at FCS, all those different challenges kind of helped prepare me for what this was like. And of course, there was the days where you just go, why did I do this? You know, I mean, not from the fact that I didn't want to be here, but just the challenges of convincing guys to practice and do all those things that they were going to have to do without games. But I think, you know, using that kind of those experiences to help mold what we were thinking. And another thing, having looked at, not many people had done this, but, you know, SMU had gone through something not self-imposed, but, you know, from the death penalty standpoint, and they went out with all freshmen for 2 years. And, you know, I don't think they won a game. And so I just, whatever we do, I wanted to at least bring in some older guys because I didn't think it was fair to go out there with all freshmen. So that was kind of what I used as the model.
Let's go to Santa Maria. Larry. Larry, what's going on? Nice to have you.
What's going on, Baron Smack? And good morning. Hope you had a great weekend, you and your family. All you guys who put your money on McGregor, please do not get mad. Just scratch your butt and get glad. T.T. Barnum said that the sucker born every day. What did you expect to happen? It's a fight, a prize fight. So you fight to win the prize, you idiots. But props to McGregor, who did not embarrass himself, and props to Money May, the only billion-dollar boxer. And James, Jim, I'm so thankful that you did not bring in Cabbage Patch for his analysis. You know who I'm talking about. Every time I think of him, think of vegetables that come to my mind with his asparagus lips and Brussels sprout earlobes, thinking he was going to go wire to wire in the smack off. He said he was coming in hot, burning hot. The only thing that was hot was this twig and berries and the STD that he caught from that skank in Jacksonville who ruined him. And I'm a big Cowboy fan, but Zeke, my man, what is wrong with you? Are you trying to wreck your career? Keep it up, and pretty soon you're going to be out of a job. And the only job you'll be able to get is on Hee-Haw as that donkey, because your ears are starting to elongate and your teeth are starting to buck. Stop it, you jackass. Hee-Haw! Hee-Haw! Give me my golden ticket, Jim. I'm out.
One of the all-time great debuts in Smack-Off history with a third-place finish this year. Jeff Passan joins us. Jeff, good to have you back. How are you today?
Jimmy, it is great to be back. I love the third place finish. I appreciate the third place finish. I feel like it was a first place finish, non-gimmick and non-script reading division. So it was a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to taking the actual crown in 2018.
All right, it's a great way to look at it. I'll look forward to 2018. I'm glad I'm going to take that as a RSVP already. One thought about that, Jeff. CBS college football writer Dennis Dodd was on the show recently. He took the opportunity to hype you for that Smack-Off performance. So how has your life changed since the Smack-Off?
I've had more clones tweeting at me, so I would argue that it has changed significantly for the worse. But you know, it's really funny. The day of the Smack-Off, honest to God, I heard from more underground clones than, like, people I didn't even know were clones were texting me saying, oh my God, I cannot believe that was just you on the Smack-Off. I number one, how did you get in? Number two, how did you go toe-to-toe with these guys? Number three, who is left, and why is he bringing a bunch of old people into Jim's studio trying to curry favor? Number four, why can't Chael Sonnen pronounce your name? What the hell is wrong with him? Is he still using too many PEDs, and is it getting to his head? I mean, the reach out from people across the United States, it just showed me how important this show is to the sporting landscape, and made me appreciate it even more than I already do.
Jeff Passan joining us. I appreciate you saying those things, Jeff. Let me just ask you, without giving anybody up, when you talk about people who are underground clones that you didn't know existed, are we talking about just friends of yours or industry types, or both?
No. We're talking about Major League Baseball general managers. We're talking about presidents of a football team, NFL football team. We're talking college football, one assistant coach. We're talking agents. I mean, these are people. It just goes to show you that the stereotype of the, you know, the clone sitting around unemployed with crumbs on his chest, you know, yelling for mom to make him a sandwich, is only true like 95% of the time.
Yeah, it's a funny line, but I'm trying to make the point that never confuse the callers with the listeners of the program. Because to your point, this underground, none of these people would ever think to pick up the phone and call the show because they've got way more important things to do. So make the distinction, and we've done that, and I appreciate it.
You know what, though? Here's an important thing. I have a lot more respect for the callers, Jim, because when you're going on in something like Smack Off and you can get run and embarrassed and just put in your place by not just the host but a litany of people who are legitimately pretty funny and pretty intelligent. Let's be honest, the people who are in the Smack Off, they're really good at what they do. You're putting yourself out there, and I have a lot of respect for people doing that, and a lot of respect for people who want to go up against the best and put their best out there and try and beat them.
I mean, you nailed it. You have this thing perfectly. It's a tough, tough room. It's a very tough room.
Yeah.
And you're out there without a net, and that's exactly how that goes. And I'm glad to know that I will see you in 2018. All right, Jeff, thanks for your thoughts on that. Let me ask you about Giancarlo Stanton. 50th home run yesterday, 29th in the last 46 games. So when you see what this guy's doing right now, what goes through your mind?
Finally. Like, we've been waiting more than half a decade for this from him. I remember I was at Giancarlo Stanton's debut, and you walk into the clubhouse, and it is just this enormous man. Like, I had not seen a baseball player like him. I assume Frank Thomas wasn't around much when I started writing about baseball, and he was a little bit older, so he wasn't quite the specimen he was when he was coming out of Auburn. But Stanton's 6'6", and he's 250, and he is just as yoked as it gets. And I hadn't seen a baseball player like that, and hadn't seen a guy who can hit the ball as consistently hard as he has. And I remember writing in the first half when Aaron Judge was doing what he was doing that Aaron Judge is what Giancarlo Stanton was supposed to be. And then you have this run that Stanton is going on right now. Like you said, 29 home runs in 46 games, 17 home runs in August alone. You know, slugging percentage up near 700 on the season now. And it's just a lot of fun to watch because baseball for years has been saying, what happens if we get the athletes who end up going to the NFL? Stanton would have been a defensive end. He would have been Julius Peppers. He would have been someone who would have been 6'6", bulked up to 290, 300, and just destroyed people off the end. But baseball kept him. And this is what happens when you get those great athletes. You get historic seasons, and that's what we're looking at from Stanton right now.
You know, in terms of the historic season, we'll get to that in 1 minute, but when you make the point about Frank Thomas, Jeff, I actually did interview him when he played in studio back in the day, and I remember being so struck by, like, this guy is gigantic. I have never seen a baseball player that big or who looked like that. Now, in terms of a historic season, Stanton was asked whether the home run record is 73 or 61. He initially said 61 is the record. Is there an asterisk attached to 73 in your mind?
I don't think so. And, you know, this sort of dovetails with the argument I get in every year at the Hall of Fame time when I'm casting my ballot. And I've in the past, sat there and thought, okay, Barry Bonds obviously used steroids. Steroids are performance enhancing. They are cheating. Ergo, Barry Bonds was a cheater and the record is not right. But as time has gone on, I've sat there and tried to really dig into this issue and tried to understand the dynamics around it and come to realize that Barry Bonds certainly was using PEDs, but a whole host of other people that we don't know about were as well. And it's not that it makes what Barry Bonds did right. What it does is, to me, confuses everything in that era. I don't know what was real. I don't know what was fake. I don't know what would have been what with or without drugs. And so to look at it through that lens, I have trouble judging what was actually done on the field at that time based on that. And I understand why people want to. I understand that there's a moral element to it. But to me, this is not something that's suddenly new in baseball. Amphetamines were being used back in the 1940s. I remember when I was working at the Kansas City Star, Ralph Kiner told me that. You know, guys came back from World War II, and the ones who were pilots would sit there popping greenies because it would wake them up. And, you know, someone on Twitter said, but Jeff, steroids made people's skulls bigger. Well, amphetamines make things inside of their skulls a lot more acute and a lot smarter. And brain chemistry, to me, is every bit as important for hitting a baseball as body composition. So, yeah, in an ideal world, I don't think that Barry Bonds' 73 home runs would stand as a record, but we don't live in an ideal world. We live in a world that's been muddied by the choices and decisions of people in the past, and we need to make our judgments based on those. And my judgment these days is that 73 is the rightful number because it's what actually happened.
Thomas in Bonanza, Oregon. Thomas, my man, what's going
on? Hey, Jim Rome, are you there?
I am, Thomas. What's up? You're on the air.
Man, I saw you on the ESPN. I missed you. I commercial fish. I go to sea. And then next thing I know, I find you on the radio, bro. I didn't even know you had a radio show.
That's incredible.
What's up? It's stunning. Hey, I want to sing a song for you, okay? It has to do with a sea shanty type song, all right?
Thomas, I can't wait to hear that song, man. Let it rip. Do what you
do,
Thomas.
Here we go. It goes like this. Where is Donika? My pretty, pretty Donika. She's all gone for beer and tenderoni. For her eyes have looked about, and her bowels are round and stout. And her tail is looking out for better weather. All for me, grog. Me jolly, jolly grog. All for my beer and green tobacco. For I spent all me tin on Danica drinking gin. And across the San Francisco Bay, I will wander. I've been crushing Canadian whiskey, and I'm drinking this stuff called Big Wave something or other beers. Yeah, man, I'm living the life.
Hey, Thomas, that song, is that still part of the song, or are you done?
I could go on if you want me to.
No, bro, that's not necessary. I think you're done. clones. As always, thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you. The new show, the Jim Rome Podcast, drops tomorrow. You can find it on iTunes, Google, and anywhere that you can find a podcast. Until then, just do what you do. Hit subscribe, tell a friend, trust the podcast, and then check back tomorrow for more Daily Jungle.